She ended the call. She paced around on the sidewalk. I snuck another look at the benches. Empty. Maybe Terrio, whatever remained of him, was heading back home to check out the scene at the good old Frederick Arms. The drumbeat intro to Rumor Has It came from the pocket of Liz's blazer. She took out her real phone and said, "Hello." She listened, then said, "Hold on, I want to record this." She did that, then said,
"Go ahead, start again."
Once the script was played out, she ended the call and put her phone away.
"It's not as strong as I'd like," she said. "But will they care?"
"Probably not once they find the bomb," I said. Liz gave a little start, and I realized she had been talking to herself. Now that I'd done what she wanted, I was just baggage. She had a roll of paper towels and a can of air freshener in the bag. She cleaned up my puke, dropped it in the gutter, $100 fine for littering, I found out later, and then sprayed the car with something that smelled like flowers.
"Get in,"
she told me. I'd been turned away so I didn't have to look at what remained of my lunchtime ravioli. As far as cleaning up the mess went, I thought she owed me that. But when I turned back to get in the car, I saw Kenneth Terrio standing by the trunk, close enough to reach out and touch me, and still grinning. I might have screamed, but when I saw him, I was between breaths, and my chest wouldn't seem to expand and grab another one. It was as if all the muscles had gone to sleep.
"I'll be seeing you," Terrio said.
The grin widened, and I could see a cake of dead blood between his teeth and cheek.
"Champ."
26. We only drove 3 blocks before she stopped again. She took out her phone, her real one, not the burner, then looked at me and saw I was shaking. I maybe could have used a hug then, but all I got was a pat on the shoulder, presumably sympathetic.
"Delayed reaction, kiddo. I know all about it. It'll pass."
Then she made a call, identified herself as Detective Dutton, and asked for Gordon Bishop. She must have been told he was on the job because Liz said,
"I don't care if he's on Mars. Patch me through. This is priority one."
She waited, tapping the fingers of her free hand on the steering wheel. Then she straightened up.
"It's Dutton. Gordo. No, I know, I'm not, but you need to hear this. I just got a tip about Terrio from someone I interviewed when I was on it. No, I don't know who. You need to check out the King Cullen in Eastport. Where he started, right, it makes a degree of sense if you think about it."
Listening, then,
"Are you kidding? How many people did we interview back then? 100? 200? Listen, I'll play you the message. I recorded it, assuming my phone worked."
She knew it had. She had checked it on our short 3-block drive. She played it for him, and when it was done, she said,
"Gordo, did you... Shit."
She ended the call.
"He hung up."
Liz gave me a grim smile.
"He hates my guts, but he'll check. He knows it'll be on him if he doesn't."
Detective Bishop did check, because by then they'd had time to start digging into Kenneth Terrio's past, and they'd found a nugget that stood out in light of Liz's anonymous tip. Long before his career in construction and his post-retirement career as an orderly at City of Angels, Terrio had grown up in the town of Westport, which is, Natch, next door to Eastport. As a high school senior, he'd been working as a bag boy and a shelf stocker at King Cullen, where he was caught shoplifting. The first time he did it, Terrio was warned. The second time, he got canned. But stealing, it seemed, was a hard habit to break. Later in life, he moved on to dynamite and blasting caps. A good supply of both was later found in a queen's storage locker. All of it old, all of it from Canada. I guess the border searches were a lot less thorough in those days.
"Can we go home now?" I asked Liz. "Please." "Yes. Are you going to tell your mother about this?"
"I don't know." She smiled.
"It was a rhetorical question. Of course you will. And that's okay. It doesn't bother me in the slightest. You know why?"
"Because nobody would believe it." She patted my hand.
"That's right, champ. Hole in one."
27. Liz dropped me off on the corner and sped away. I walked down to our building. My mother and Barbara hadn't gone for that drink after all. Barb had a cold and said she was going home right after work. Mom was on the steps with her phone in her hand. She flew down the steps when she saw me coming and grabbed me in a panicky hug that squeezed the breath out of me.
Where the fuck were you, James?
She only called me that when she was super pissed, which you might have already guessed.
How could you be so thoughtless? I've been calling everyone. I was starting to think you'd been kidnapped. I even thought of calling.
She quit hugging me and held me at arm's length. I could see she had been crying and was starting to again, and that made me feel really bad, even though none of it had been my fault. I think only your mother can truly make you feel lower than whale shit.
Was it Liz?
And, without waiting for an answer,
it was.
Then, in a low and deadly voice,
that bitch.
I had to go with her, Mom, I said. I really had to. Then I started to cry too. 28. We went upstairs. Mom made coffee and gave me a cup. My first, and I've been a fool for the stuff ever since. I told her almost everything. How Liz had been waiting outside school. How she told me lives depended on finding Thumper's last bomb. How we went to the hospital and to Terrio's building. I even told her how awful Terrio looked with half his head blown out of shape on one side. What I didn't tell her was how I'd turned around to see him standing behind Liz's car, close enough to grab my arm, if dead people can grab, a thing I never wanted to find out one way or the other. And I didn't tell her what he'd said. But that night, when I went to bed, it clanged in my head like a cracked bell.
I'll be seeing you, champ.
Mom kept saying, okay, and I understand, all the time looking more distressed. But she had to know what was happening on Long Island, and so did I. She turned on the TV and we sat on the couch to watch. Lewis Dodley of New York One was doing a stand-up on a street with police sawhorses blocking it off. Police appear to be taking this tip very seriously, he was saying. According to a source in the Suffolk County Police Department, I remembered the news helicopter flying over the Frederick Arms and figured it must have had enough time to chopper out to Long Island, so I grabbed the remote from my mother's lap and flipped over to Channel 4. And there, sure enough, was the roof of the King Cullen supermarket. The parking lot was full of police cars. Parked by the main doors was a big van that just about had to belong to the bomb squad. I saw two helmeted cops with a pair of dogs on harnesses going inside. The chopper was too high to see if the bomb squad cops were wearing bulletproof vests and flak jackets as well as helmets, but I'm sure they were. Not the dogs, though. If Thumper's bomb went off while they were inside, the dogs would be blown to mush. The reporter in the chopper was saying, "We've been told that all customers and store personnel have been safely evacuated, although it's possible this is just another false alarm. There have been many during Thumper's reign of terror."
Yep, he actually said that.
"Taking these things seriously is always the wisest course. All we know now is that this was the site of Thumper's first bomb and that no bomb has been found yet. Let's send it back to the studio."
The chromo behind the news anchors had a picture of Terrio, maybe his City of Angels ID because he looked pretty old. He was no movie star, but he looked a hell of a lot better than he had sitting on that bench. Liz's manufactured tip might not have been taken so seriously had it not caused one of the older detectives in the department to recall a case from his childhood, that of George Metesky, dubbed the Mad Bomber by the press. Metesky planted 33 pipe bombs during his own reign of terror, which lasted from 1940 to 1956. And the seed was a similar grudge, in his case, against Consolidated Edison. Some quick researcher in the news department had also made the connection, and Metesky's face came up next on the chromo behind the anchors, but Mom didn't bother looking at the old guy, who, I thought, looked weirdly like Terrio in his orderly's uniform. She had grabbed her phone, then went muttering into her bedroom for her address book, presumably having deleted Liz's number after their argument about the serious weight. A commercial for some pill came on, so I crept to her bedroom door to listen. If I'd waited, I wouldn't have heard jack shit, because the call didn't last that long.
It's Tia, Liz. Listen to me and don't say a word. I'm going to keep this to myself for reasons that should be obvious to you, but if you ever bother my son again, if he even sees you, I will burn your life to the ground. You know I can do it. All it would take is one single push. Stay away from Jamie.
I scurried back to the couch and pretended to be absorbed in the next commercial, which turned out to be as useless as tits on a bull.
You heard that?
Her eyes were burning, telling me not to lie. I nodded.
Good. If you see her again, you run like hell home and tell me. Do you understand?
I nodded again.
Okay. Right. I'm ordering takeout. Do you want pizza or Chinese?
29. The cops found and defused Thumper's last bomb that Wednesday night around 8 o'clock. Mom and me were watching Person of Interest on TV when the station broke in with a special bulletin. The sniffer dogs had made lots of passes without finding anything, and their bomb squad handlers were about to take them out when one of them alerted in the housewares aisle. They'd been in that one several times before, and there was no place on the shelves to hide a bomb, but one of the cops happened to look up and saw a ceiling panel just slightly out of place. That's where the bomb was, between the ceiling and the roof. It was tied to a girder with a stretchy orange cord, like the kind bungee jumpers use. Terrio really blew his wad on that one, 16 sticks of dynamite and a dozen blasting caps. He'd moved far beyond alarm clocks. The bomb was hooked up to a digital timer, very much like the ones in those movies I'd been thinking about. One of the cops took a picture after it was disarmed, and it was in the next day's New York Times. It was set to go off at 5 p.m. on Friday, when the store was always busiest. The next day on New York One, we were back to Mom's fave, one of the bomb squad guys said it would have brought the whole roof down. When asked how many people might have been killed in such a blast, he only shook his head. That Thursday night, as we ate dinner, my mother said,
"You did a good thing, Jamie. A fine thing. Liz did too, whatever her reasons might have been. It makes me think of something Marty said once."
She meant Mr. Burkett, actually Professor Burkett, still emeritus and still hanging in.
What did he say?
"Sometimes God uses a broken tool." It was from one of the old English writers he used to teach.
"He always asks me what I'm learning in school," I said, "and he always shakes his head like he's thinking I'm getting a bad education."
Mom laughed.
"There's a man who's stuffed with education, and he's still totally sharp and in focus. Remember when we had Christmas dinner with him?"
"Sure, turkey sandwiches with cranberry dressing, the best, plus hot chocolate."
"Yes, that was a good night. It will be a shame when he passes on. Eat up. There's apple crisp for dessert. Barbara made it. And Jamie?"
I looked at her.
"Could we not talk about this anymore? Just kind of put it behind us?"
I thought she wasn't just talking about Liz or even Terrio. She was also talking about how I could see dead folks. It was what our computer teacher might have called a global request, and it was all right with me. More than all right, actually.
"Sure."
Right then, sitting in our brightly lit kitchen nook and eating pizza, I really thought we could put it behind us. Only I was wrong. I didn't see Liz Dutton for another 2 years and hardly ever thought about her. But I saw Ken Terrio again that very night. As I said at the beginning, this is a horror story.
30.
I was almost asleep when two cats started yowling their heads off and jerked fully awake. We were on the fifth floor, and I might not have heard it, and the clatter of a trash can that followed if my windows hadn't been cracked to let in some fresh air.
I got up to shut it and froze with my hands on the sash. Terrio was standing across the street in the spreading glow of a street lamp, and I knew right away that the cats hadn't been yowling because they were fighting. They had been yowling because they were scared. The baby in the papoose carrier had seen him, so had those cats. He scared them on purpose. He knew I would come to the window, just as he knew Liz called me Champ. He grinned from his half-destroyed head. He beckoned. I closed the window and thought about going into my mother's room to get in bed with her, only I was too big for that and there would be questions, so I pulled the shade instead. I went back to my own bed and lay there, looking up into the dark. Nothing like this had ever happened to me before. No dead person had ever followed me home like a fucking stray dog. Never mind, I thought. In 3 or 4 days, he'll be gone like all of them are gone. A week, at most. And it's not like he can hurt you. But could I be sure of that? Lying there in the dark, I realized I wasn't. Seeing dead folks didn't mean knowing dead folks. At last, I went back to the window and peeked around the shade, sure he'd still be there. Maybe he'd even beckon again. One finger pointing and then curling. Come here. Come to me, Champ. No one was under the streetlight. He was gone. I went back to bed, but it took me a long time to go to sleep.
31. I saw him again on Friday, outside of school. There were quite a few parents waiting for their kids. There always are on Fridays, probably because they're going somewhere for the weekend. And they didn't see Terrio, but they must have felt him, because they gave the place where he was standing a wide berth. No one was pushing a baby in a carriage, but if someone had been, I knew that baby would be looking at the empty spot on the sidewalk and bawling its head off. I went back inside and looked at some posters outside the office, wondering what to do. I supposed I'd have to talk to him, find out what he wanted, and I made up my mind to do it right then while there were people around. I didn't think he could hurt me, but I didn't know. I used the boys' room first because all at once I really had to pee, but when I was standing at the urinal, I couldn't squeeze out even a single drop. So I went out, holding my backpack by the strap instead of wearing it. I had never been touched by a dead person, not once. I didn't know if they could touch, but if Terrio tried to touch me or grab me, I intended to hit him with a sack full of books. Only he was gone. A week went by, then two. I relaxed, figuring he had to be past his sell-by date. I was on the YMCA junior swim team, and on a Saturday in late May, we had our final practice for an upcoming meet in Brooklyn, which would take place the following weekend. Mom gave me $10 for something to eat afterwards and told me, as she always did, to make sure I locked my locker so no one would steal the money or my watch, although why anyone would want to steal a lousy Timex, I have no idea. I asked her if she was coming to the meet. She looked up from the manuscript she was reading and said, "For the fourth time, Jamie, yes. I'm coming to the meet, it's on my calendar." It was only the second time I'd asked, or maybe the third, but I didn't tell her that, only kissed her on the cheek and headed down the hall to the elevator. When the doors opened, Terrio was in there, grinning his grin and staring at me from his good eye and the stretched out one. There was a piece of paper pinned to his shirt. The suicide note was on it. The note was always on it, and the blood spattered across it was always fresh.
"Your mother has cancer, Champ, from the cigarettes. She'll be dead in 6 months."
I was frozen in place with my mouth hanging open. The elevator doors rolled shut. I made some kind of sound, a squeak, a moan, I don't know, and leaned back against the wall so I wouldn't fall down. "They have to tell you the truth," I thought. "My mother is going to die." but then my head cleared a little and a better thought came. I grasped it like a drowning man clutching at a floating piece of wood. But maybe they only have to tell the truth if you ask them questions. Otherwise, maybe they can tell you any kind of fake shit they want. I didn't want to go to swim practice after that, but if I didn't, Coach might call Mom to ask where I'd been. And she would want to know where I'd been, and what was I going to tell her? That I was afraid that Thumper would be waiting for me on the corner, or in the lobby of the Y? Or, somehow this was the most horrible, in the shower room, unseen by naked boys rinsing off the chlorine? Was I going to tell her that she had fucking cancer? So, I went. And as you might guess, I swam for shit. Coach told me to get my head on straight, and I had to pinch my armpit to keep from bursting into tears. I had to pinch it really hard. When I got home, Mom was still deep in her manuscript. I hadn't seen her smoking since Liz left, but I knew she sometimes drank when I wasn't there, with her authors and various editors. So I sniffed at her when I kissed her and didn't smell anything but a little perfume. Or maybe face cream, since it was Saturday, some kind of lady stuff anyway.
Are you coming down with a cold, Jamie? You dried off well after swimming, didn't you?
Yeah. Mom, you're not smoking anymore, are you?
So that's it.
She put aside the manuscript and stretched.
No, I haven't had one since Liz left.
Since you kicked her out, I thought.
Have you been to the doctor lately to get a checkup?
She looked at me quizzically.
What's this about? You've got that crease between your brows.
Well, I said, you're the only parent I've got. If something happened to you, I couldn't exactly go live with Uncle Harry, could I? She made a funny face at that, then laughed and hugged me.
I'm fine, kiddo. I had the old annual checkup 2 months ago, as a matter of fact, passed with flying colors.
And she looked okay. In the pink, as the saying goes. Hadn't lost any more weight that I could see and wasn't coughing her brains out. Although cancer didn't just have to be in a person's throat or lungs, I knew that.
Well, that's good. I'm glad. That makes two of us. Now, make your mom a cup of coffee and let me finish this manuscript.
Is it a good one?
As a matter of fact, it is.
Better than Mr. Thomas's Roanoke books?
Much better, but not as commercial, alas.
Can I have a cup of coffee?
She sighed. Half a cup. Now let me read.
32. During my last test in math that year, I looked out the window and saw Kenneth Terrio standing on the basketball court. He did his grinning and beckoning thing. I looked back at my paper, then looked up again. Still there. And closer. He turned his head so I could get a good look at the purple-black crater plus the bone fangs sticking up all around it. I looked down at my paper again, and when I looked up the third time, he was gone. But I knew he'd be back. He wasn't like the others. He was nothing like the others. By the time Mr. Lagari told us to turn in our papers, I still hadn't solved the last 5 problems. I got a D- on the test, and there was a note at the top. This is disappointing, Jamie. You must do better. What do I say? At least once in every class. What he said was that if you fell behind in math, you could never catch up. Math wasn't so special that way, although Mr. Lagari might think so. It was true for most classes. As if to underline the point, I bricked a history test later that day. Not because Terrio was standing at the blackboard or anything, but because I couldn't stop thinking he might be standing at the blackboard. I got the idea he wanted me to do badly in my courses. You could laugh at that, but there's another old saying that goes, it's not paranoid if it's true. A few lousy tests weren't going to stop me from passing everything, not that late in the year. And then it would be summer vacation, but what about next year, if he was still hanging around? Also, what if he was getting stronger? I didn't want to believe that, but just the fact that he was still there suggested it might be true, that it probably was true. Telling somebody might help, and Mom was the logical choice. She'd believe me, but I didn't want to scare her. She'd already been scared enough when she thought the agency was going to go under and she wouldn't be able to take care of me and her brother. That I'd helped her out of that pickle might make her blame herself for the one I was in now. That made no sense to me, but it might to her. Besides, she wanted to put the whole seeing dead folks stuff behind her. And here's the thing, what could she do, even if I did tell her? Blame Liz for putting me with Terrio in the first place, but that was all. I thought briefly of talking to Miss Peterson, who was the school's guidance counselor, but she'd assume I was having hallucinations, maybe a nervous breakdown. She'd tell my mother. I even thought of going to Liz, but what could Liz do? Pull out her gun and shoot him? Good luck there, since he was already dead. Besides, I was done with Liz, or so I thought. I was on my own, and that was a lonely, scary place to be. My mother came to the swim meet where I swam like shit in every event. On the way home, she gave me a hug and told me everyone had an off day and I'd do better next time. I almost blurted everything out right then, ending with my fear, which I now felt was reasonably justified, that Kenneth Terrio was trying to ruin my life for screwing up his last and biggest bomb. If we hadn't been in a taxi, I really might have. Since we were, I just put my head on her shoulder, as I had when I was small, and thought my hand turkey was the greatest work of art since the Mona Lisa. Tell you what, the worst part of growing up is how it shuts you up. 33. When I headed out of our apartment on the last day of school, Terrio was once again in the elevator, grinning and beckoning. He probably expected me to cringe back like I had the first time I saw him in there, but I didn't. I was scared, all right, but not as scared, because I was getting used to him the way you might get used to a growth or a birthmark on your face, even if it was ugly. This time, I was more angry than scared because he wouldn't leave me the fuck alone. Instead of cringing, I lunged forward and put my arm out to stop the elevator doors. I wasn't gonna get in with him, Christ no, but I wasn't gonna let the doors close until I got a few answers. Does my mother really have cancer? Once again, his face twisted like I was hurting him, and once again, I hoped I was. Does my mother have cancer? I don't know. The way he was staring at me, you know that old saying about if looks could kill? Then why did you say that? He was at the back of the car now, with his hands pressed to his chest, as if I was scaring him. He turned his head, showing me that enormous exit wound, but if he thought that was going to make me let go of the door and step back, he was wrong. Horrible as it was, I'd gotten used to it.
Why did you say that?
Because I hate you,
Terrio said, and bared his teeth.
Why are you still here? How can you be?
I don't know.
Go away.
He said nothing.
Go away!
I'm not going away. I'm never going away.
That scared the hell out of me, and my arm flopped down to my side as if it had gained weight.
Be seeing you, champ.
The elevator doors rolled shut, but the car didn't go anywhere because there was no one to push any of the inside buttons. When I pushed the one on my side, the doors rolled open on an empty car, but I took the stairs anyway. I'll get used to him, I thought. I got used to the hole in his head, and I'll get used to him. It's not like he can hurt me. But in some ways, he'd hurt me already. The D-minus on my math test and screwing the pooch at the swim meet were just two examples. I was sleeping badly, Mom had already commented on the pouches under my eyes, and little noises, even a dropped book in study hall, made me jump. I kept thinking I'd open my closet to get a shirt, and he'd be in there, my own personal boogeyman, or under the bed, and what if he grabbed my wrist or my dangling foot while I was sleeping? I didn't think he could grab, but I wasn't sure of that either, especially if he was getting stronger. What if I woke up and he was lying in bed with me, maybe even grabbing at my junk? That was an idea that, once thought, couldn't be unthought. And something else. Something even worse. What if he was still haunting me? Because that's what this was, all right. When I was 20 or 40, what if he was there when I died at 89, waiting to welcome me into the afterlife, where he would go on haunting me even after I was dead. If this is what a good deed gets you, I thought one night, looking out my window and watching Thumper across the street under his streetlight, I never want to do another one. 34. In late June, Mom and I made our monthly visit to see Uncle Harry. He didn't talk much anymore, and hardly ever went into the common room. Although he still wasn't 50, his hair had gone snow white. Mom said,
"Jamie brought you some arugula from Zabar's, Harry. Would you like some?"
I held the bag up from my place in the doorway. I didn't really want to go all the way in, smiling and feeling a little like one of the models on The Price is Right. Uncle Harry said, "Does that mean yes?" Mom asked. Uncle Harry said, and waved both hands at me, which he didn't have to be a mind reader to know meant no fucking cookies.
"Would you like to go out? It's beautiful."
I wasn't sure Uncle Harry even knew what out was these days.
"I'll help you up,"
Mom said, and took his arm.
"No,"
Uncle Harry said. "Not not yeeg, not ugh. No." As clear as a bell. His eyes had gotten big and were starting to water. Then, also clear as a bell,
"Who's that?"
"It's Jamie. You know Jamie, Harry." Only he didn't know me, not anymore, and it wasn't me he was looking at. He was looking over my shoulder. I didn't need to turn around to know what I was going to see there, but I did anyway.
"What he's got is hereditary," Terrio said. "And it runs in the male line. You'll be like him, champ. You'll be like him before you know it."
"Jamie?" Mom asked. "Are you okay?" "Fine," I said, looking at Terrio. "I'm just fine." But I wasn't. And Terrio's grin said he knew it, too.
"Go away,"
Uncle Harry said.
"Go away! Go away! Go away!"
So we did. All three of us. 35. I had just about decided to tell my mother everything. I needed to let it out, even if it scared her and made her unhappy, when fate, as the saying is, took a hand. This was in July of 2013, about 3 weeks after our trip to see Uncle Harry. My mother got a call early one morning while she was getting ready to go to the office. I was sitting at the kitchen table, scarfing up Cheerios with one eye open. She came out of her bedroom, zipping her skirt.
"Marty Burkett had a little accident last night. Tripped over something going to the toilet, I imagined, and strained his hip. He says he's fine, and maybe he is, but maybe he's just trying to be macho."
"Yeah," I said, mostly because it was safer to agree with my mom when she's rushing around and trying to do like three different things at once. Privately, I was thinking that Mr. Burkett was a little old to be a macho man, although it was amusing to think of him starring in a movie like Terminator: The Retirement Years, waving his cane and proclaiming, "I'll be back." I picked up my bowl and started to slurp the milk.
"Jamie, how many times have I told you not to do that?"
I couldn't remember if she ever had, because quite a few parental edicts, especially those concerning table manners, had a tendency to slide by me.
"How else am I supposed to get it all?" she sighed. "Never mind. I made a casserole for our supper, but we could have burgers. If, that is, you could interrupt your busy schedule of watching TV and playing games on your phone long enough to take it to Marty." "I can't, full schedule. I don't suppose you'd be willing to do that, and then call me and tell me how he's doing?"
At first, I didn't answer. I felt like I'd just been hit on the head with a hammer. Some ideas are like that. Also, I felt like a total dumbo. Why had I never thought of Mr. Burkett before?
"Jamie? Earth to Jamie?"
"Sure," I said. "Happy to do it."
"Really?
Really?
Are you sick? Do you have a fever?"
"Ha ha," I said. "Funny as a rubber crutch." She grabbed her purse.
"I'll give you cab fare."
"Nah, just put the casserole thing in a carry bag. I'll walk."
"Really?"
she said again, looking surprised.
"All the way to park?"
"Sure, I can use the exercise." Not strictly true.
What I needed was time to be sure my idea was a good idea and how to tell my story if it was. 36. At this point, I'm going to start calling Mr. Burkett Professor Burkett because he taught me that day. He taught me a lot. But before the teaching, he listened. I've already said that I knew I had to talk to somebody, but I didn't know what a relief it would be to unburden myself until I actually did it. He came to the door, hobbling on not just one cane, which I'd seen him use before, but two. His face lit up when he saw me, so I guess he was glad to get company. Kids are pretty self-involved, as I'm sure you know if you've ever been one yourself, haha. And I only realized later that he must have been a lonely, lonely man in the years after Mona died. He had that daughter on the West Coast, but if she came to visit, I never saw her. See statement above about kids and self-involvement.
Jamie, you come bearing gifts.
Just the casserole, I said. I think it's a Swedish pie.
You may mean shepherd's pie. I'm sure it's delicious. Would you be kind enough to put it in the icebox for me? I've got these.
He lifted the canes off the floor, and for one scary moment I thought he was going to faceplant right in front of me, but then he got them braced again in time. Sure, I said, and went into the kitchen. I got a kick out of how he called the fridge the icebox, and cars, autos. He was totally old school. Oh, and he also called the telephone the telefungus. I liked that one so much I started using it myself. Still do. Getting Mom's casserole into the icebox was no problem because he had almost nothing in there. He stumped in after me and asked how I was doing. I shut the icebox door, turned to him, and said, "Not so well." He raised his shaggy eyebrows.
"No? What's the problem?"
"It's a pretty long story," I said, "and you'll probably think I'm crazy, but I have to tell somebody, and I guess you're elected."
"Is it about Mona's rings?"
My mouth dropped open. Professor Burkett smiled.
"I never quite believed that your mother just happened to find them in the closet. Too fortuitous, far too fortuitous. It crossed my mind to think she put them there herself, but every human action is predicated on motive and opportunity, and your mother had neither. Also, I was too upset to really think about it that afternoon."
"Because you'd just lost your wife."
"Indeed."
He raised one cane enough to touch the heel of his palm to his chest, where his heart was. That made me feel bad for him.
"So what happened, Jamie? I suppose it's all water under the bridge at this point, but as a lifetime reader of detective stories, I like to know the answers to such questions."
"Your wife told me," I said. He stared at me across the kitchen. "I see the dead," I said. He didn't reply for so long, I got scared. Then he said,
"I think I need something with caffeine. I think we both do. Then you can tell me everything that's on your mind. I long to hear it."
37. Professor Burkett was so old school that he didn't have tea bags, just loose tea in a canister. While I waited for his hot pot to boil, he showed me where to find what he called a tea ball and instructed me on how much of the loose tea to put in. Brewing tea was an interesting process. I will always prefer coffee, but sometimes a pot of tea is just the thing. Making it feels formal, somehow. Professor Burkett told me the tea had to steep for 5 minutes in freshly boiled water, no more and no less. He set the timer, showed me where the cups were, and then stumped into the living room. I heard his sigh of relief when he sat down in his favorite chair. Also, a fart. Not a trumpet blast, more of an oboe. I made 2 cups of tea and put them on a tray along with the sugar bowl and the half and half from the icebox, which neither of us used, probably a good thing since it was a month past its sell-by date. Professor Burkett took his black and smacked his lips over the first sip.
Kudos, Jamie. Perfect on your first try.
Thanks. I sugared mine up liberally. My mom would have screamed at that third heaping spoonful, but Professor Burkett never said boo.
"Now, tell me your tale.
I've nothing but time. Do you believe me? About the rings?
Well, he said, I believe that you believe. And I know that the rings were found. They're in my bank safety deposit box. Tell me, Jamie, if I asked your mother, would she corroborate your story?
Yes, but please don't do that. I decided to talk to you because I don't want to talk to her. It would upset her.
He sipped his tea with a hand that shook slightly, then put it down and looked at me. Or maybe even into me. I can still see those bright blue eyes peering out from beneath his shaggy, every-which-way brows.
Then talk to me. Convince me.
Having rehearsed my story on my crosstown walk, I was able to keep it in a pretty straight line. I started with Robert Harrison, you know, the Central Park man, and moved on to seeing Mrs. Burkitt. Then all the rest. It took quite a while. When I finished, my tea was down to just lukewarm, maybe even a little less, but I drank a bunch of it anyway because my throat was dry. Professor Burkitt considered, then said,
Will you go into my bedroom, Jamie, and bring me my iPad? It's on the night table.
His bedroom smelled sort of like Uncle Harry's room in the care home, plus some sharp aroma that I guessed was liniment for his strained hip. I got his iPad and brought it back. He didn't have an iPhone, just a landline telefungus that hung on the kitchen wall like something in an old movie, but he loved his pad. He opened it when I gave it to him. The startup screen was a picture of a young couple in wedding outfits that I assumed was him and Mrs. Burkitt, and started poking away at once.
Are you looking up Terrio?
He shook his head without looking up.
You're Central Park man. You say you were in preschool when you saw him?
Yes.
So this would have been 2003, possibly 2004. Ah, here it is.
He read, bent over the pad and occasionally brushing his hair out of his eyes. He had a lot of it. At last, he looked up and said,
You saw him lying there, dead, and also standing beside himself. Your mother would also confirm that?
She knew I wasn't lying because I knew what the guy was wearing on top, even though that part of him was covered up. But I really don't want—
Understood, totally understood. Now, concerning Regis Thomas's last book, it was unwritten.
Yeah, except for the first couple of chapters, I think.
But your mother was able to glean enough details to write the rest of it herself, using you as her medium.
I hadn't thought of myself as a medium, but in a way he was right.
I guess. Like in The Conjuring.
And off his puzzled expression,
it's a movie. Mr. Burkitt, Professor, do you think I'm crazy?
I almost didn't care because the relief of getting it all out there was so great.
No,
he said, but something, probably my expression of relief, caused him to raise a warning finger.
This is not to say I believe your story, at least not without corroboration from your mother, which I have agreed not to ask for, but I will go this far. I don't necessarily disbelieve, mostly because of the rings, but also because that last Thomas book does indeed exist. Not that I've read it.
He made a little face at that.
You say your mother's friend, ex-friend, could also corroborate the last and most colorful part of your story?
Yes, but—
He raised his hand like he must have done 1,000 times to babbling students in class.
You don't want me to speak to her either, and I quite understand. I only met her once, and I didn't care for her. Did she really bring drugs into your home?
I didn't see them myself, but if my mom said she did, she did.
He put his pad aside and fondled his go-to cane, which had a big white knob on the top.
And Tia is well rid of her. And this Terrio, who you say is haunting you, is he here now?
No.
But I looked around to be sure.
You want to be rid of him, of course.
Yes, but I don't know how to do it.
He sipped his tea, brooded over the cup, then set it down and fixed me with those blue eyes again. He was old. They weren't.
An interesting problem, especially for an elderly gentleman who's encountered all sorts of supernatural creatures in his reading life. The Gothics are full of them. Frankenstein's monster and Count Dracula being just the pair who show up most frequently on movie marquees. There are many more in European literature and folk tales. Let's presume, at least for the moment, that this Terrio isn't just in your head. Let's presume he actually exists. I kept myself from protesting that he did exist. The professor already knew what I believed. He'd said so himself. Let us go a step further. Based on what you've told me about your other sightings of dead people, including my wife, all of them go away after a few days, disappear to, he waved his hand, to wherever, but not this Terrio. He's still around, and in fact, you think he may be getting stronger.
I'm pretty sure he is.
If so, perhaps he's not really Kenneth Terrio at all anymore. Perhaps what remained of Terrio after death has been infested. That's the correct word, not possessed, by a demon. He must have seen my expression because he hastened to add, We are just speculating here, Jamie. I'm going to speak frankly and say I think it far more likely that you're suffering from a localized fugue state that has caused hallucinations.
In other words, crazy. At that point, I was still glad I'd told him, but his conclusion was maximo depressing, even though I had been more or less expecting it. He waved a hand.
Bosh, I don't think that at all. You're obviously operating in the real world as well as ever. And I must admit, your story is full of things that are hard to explain in strictly rational terms. I don't doubt that you accompanied Tia and her ex-friend to the deceased Mr. Thomas's home, nor do I doubt that Detective Dutton took you to Terrio's place of employment and his apartment building. If she did those things, I am channeling Ellery Queen here, one of my favorite apostles of deduction, she must have believed in your mediumistic talents, which in turn leads us back to Mr. Thomas's home, where Detective Dutton must have seen something to convince her of that in the first place.
You lost me, I said.
Never mind. He leaned forward. All I'm saying is that although I lean toward the rational, the known, and the empiric, having never seen a ghost or had a flash of precognition, I must admit there are elements of your story I can't dismiss out of hand. So, let us say that Terrio, or something nasty that has inhabited what remains of Terrio, actually exists. The question then becomes, can you get rid of him?
Now I was leaning forward, thinking of the book he'd given me, the one full of fairy tales that were really horror stories with very few happy endings. The stepsisters cut off their toes, the princess threw the frog against the wall, splat, instead of kissing him. Red Riding Hood actually encouraged the big bad wolf to eat Grandma so she could inherit Grandma's property. Can I? You've read all those books. There must be a way in at least one of them, or...
A new idea struck me.
Exorcism! What about that?
Probably a non-starter, Professor Burkett said. I think a priest would be more apt to send you to a child psychiatrist than an exorcist. If your Terrio exists, Jamie... You may be stuck with him.
I stared at him with dismay.
But maybe that's all right.
All right? How can it be all right?
He lifted his cup, sipped, and set it down.
Have you ever heard of the ritual of Chud?
38. Now I'm 22, almost 23 in fact, and living in the land of later. I can vote, I can drive, I can buy booze and cigarettes, which I plan to quit soon. I understand that I'm still very young, and I'm sure that when I look back, I'll be amazed, hopefully not disgusted, by how naive and wet behind the ears I was. Still, 22 is light years from 13. I know more now, but I believe less. Professor Birkett would never have been able to work the same magic on me now that he did back then. Not that I'm complaining. Kenneth Terrio, I don't know what he really was, so let's stick with that for now, was trying to destroy my sanity. The professor's magic saved it. It may even have saved my life. Later, when I researched the subject for an anthropology paper in college, NYU, of course, I discovered half of what he told me that day was actually true. The other half was bullshit. I have to give him credit for invention, though.
Full marks,
Mom's British romance writer Philippa Stevens would have said. Check this out and dig the irony. My Uncle Harry wasn't even 50 and totally gaga, while Martin Birkett, although in his 80s, could still be creative on the fly. And all in service of a troubled boy who'd turned up uninvited bearing a casserole and a weird story. The ritual of Chud, the professor said, was practiced by a sect of Tibetan and Nepalese Buddhists. True. They did it to achieve a sense of perfect nothingness and the resulting state of serenity and spiritual clarity. True. It was also considered useful in combating demons, both those in the mind and the supernatural ones who invaded from the outside. A gray area.
Which makes it perfect for you, Jamie, because it covers all the bases.
You mean it can work even if Terrio's really not there and I'm just crazy pants? He gave me a look combining reproach and impatience that he probably perfected in his teaching career.
Stop talking and try listening if you don't mind.
Sorry. I was on my second cup of tea and feeling wired. With the groundwork laid, Professor Birkett now moved into the land of make-believe. Not that I knew the difference. He said that Chud was especially useful when one of these high country Buddhists encountered a Yeti, also known as the Abominable Snowman. Are those things real? I asked.
As with your Mr. Terrio, I can't say with any surety, but also, as with you and your Mr. Terrio, I can say that the Tibetans believe they are.
The professor went on to say that a person unfortunate enough to meet a Yeti would be haunted by it for the rest of his life. Unless, that is, it could be engaged and bested in the ritual of Chud. If you're following this, you know that if bullshit was an event at the Olympics, the judges would have given Professor Birkett all tens for that one. But I was only 13 and in a bad place, which is to say I swallowed it whole. If part of me had an idea of what Professor Birkett was up to, I can't really remember, I shut it down. You have to remember how desperate I was. The idea of being followed around by Kenneth Terrio, aka Thumper, for the rest of my life, haunted by him, to use the professor's word, was the most horrible thing I could imagine.
How does it work? I asked.
Ah, you'll like this. It's like one of the uncensored fairy tales in the book I gave you. According to the stories, you and the demon bind yourselves together by biting into each other's tongues.
He said this with a certain relish, and I thought, like it? Why would I like it?
Once this union has been accomplished, you and the demon have a battle of wills. This would occur telepathically, I assume, since it would be hard to talk while engaged in a mutual tongue bite. The first to withdraw loses all power over the winner.
I stared at him, my mouth open. I had been raised to be polite, especially around my mother's clients and acquaintances, but I was too grossed out to consider the social niceties.
If you think I'm gonna, French kiss that guy, you're out of your mind. For one thing, he's dead. Did you not get that?
Yes, Jamie, I believe I did.
Besides, how would I even get him to do it? What would I say, come on over here, Ken, honey, and slip me some tongue?
Are you finished?
Professor Birkett asked mildly, once again making me feel like the most clueless student in class.
I think the tongue-biting aspect is meant to be symbolic. The way chunks of Wonder Bread and little thimbles of wine are meant to be symbolic of Jesus' Last Supper with his disciples.
I didn't get that, not being much of a churchgoer, so I kept my mouth shut.
Listen to me, Jamie. Listen very carefully. I listened as if my life depended on it, because I thought it did.
39. As I was preparing to leave, politeness had resurfaced and I didn't neglect to tell him thank you. The professor asked me if his wife had said anything else, besides about where the rings were, that was. By the time you're 13, I think you've forgotten most of the things that have happened to you when you're 6. I mean, that's more than half your life ago, but I didn't have any trouble remembering that day. I could have told him how Mrs. Burkett threw shade about my green turkey, but figured that wouldn't interest him. He wanted to know if she'd said anything about him, not what she'd said to me. You were hugging my mom, and she said you were going to burn her hair with your cigarette. And you did. Guess you quit smoking, huh?
I allow myself 3 a day. I suppose I could have more. I'm not going to be cut down in my youth, but 3 is all I seem to want. Did she say anything else?
That you'd be having lunch